Tested live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
Very good evening to you, Prophet Divine Fu. Thank you so much for making time for us, and you're welcome on Point of View.
Good evening. Thank you for inviting, and good evening to your listeners. I'm happy to be here.
I want us to talk about your appointment, and congratulations once again.
Thank you, Pamela, and thank you for inviting.
Yes. Even how does it land with you? You've been, you know, on this journey for a long time as an academic. You've traversed the globe, in fact, not just one part of the country or the continent. How does this particular appointment land?
It's a burden that we all have to carry. And I call it national service as an academic in the department. We all have the responsibility, but the Department of Anthropology is very particular because of its history. It is the home of Mafeji, it's the home of Rampella and many other persons, so it's a very important space. Mm.
I just want to talk a little bit about the work that you've done, and, you know, to contextualize it, you're saying, you know, it's service, really, to be quite frank. And let's contextualize it in this modern South Africa, in this modern day Africa, and its challenges. And referring to some of the work that you've done, your thoughts on how the youth is coping with the challenges that we are experiencing right now. And if we just maybe start with maybe South Africa and looking outward in how we can better accommodate the youth who I think are feeling a little unseen at the moment, especially with regards to the challenges that the continent is facing.
Young people, when you grow up, you're always told that you are the future of tomorrow. Mm. So if you work hard today, yeah, and you must work hard today because, you know, you must prepare yourself for tomorrow. Yeah. But then our generation, that I think the generation that we are training, grows up and continues to experience the world in which their adulthood gets suspended and suspended because gerontocracy continues, you know, to extend, because you also have suspended youth. The struggle in South Africa for liberation has meant that many people's youth have been extended, and that people have become adults very late. And across the African continent, across the world, the economic struggles that we are facing mean that many young people's route to adulthood is suspended, and people become adults very, very late on in their life. So they have so many struggles. You study, the school to work transition is no longer possible as it was before. You get a matric, doesn't necessarily mean you get a job. You have to keep accumulating the certificates. You accumulate degrees, you discover that you can have 2-3 PhDs still. Doesn't mean you don't have a profession. So it's a really challenging space in which we find ourselves, and young people begin to find many different alternatives to define what it is to be adult or to experience adulthood, which is suspended for them. Yeah.
And talk to me about what you've observed with how resilient they've become, how they are, you know, using their own agency to cope with all the challenges that you just referred to.
I think resilience is a term that we keep using now, but there is a term from the Arab Spring, and also from the Mozambican scholar Asinda Honwano, which is waithood. Waithood, which is a space in which you are waiting to become forever. That so many people are trapped in waithood. My other friend Jude Fokwang's talk about liminality and illiminality, that we are in a state in which young people are both here and there, and neither here nor there. Mm. So the end is that you have no choice but to leave. You have to leave, you know. In the past, it was survival, because survival would lead you somewhere. You are surviving because you are suspending, preparing to get somewhere. But in this context, you have no choice but to leave, but no choice but to survive. Mm. And I think young people are not just coping. They are just leaving. Because there is no other way. When your adulthood is suspended, it just means that if you don't just experience life now and you don't live as an adult now, you will be suspending your own adulthood and living in youth and adolescence for really, really long periods. Look across the world and see our leadership. The ages across the world. Look at the economy. Look at whether it's the corporate sector or the non-corporate sector. You see that while young people are present, still leadership is still very old. So young people have no choice but to leave.
So what impact does that then have on society, particularly the poorer communities, urban communities, which have to then carry this young person who, as you're saying, you know, is in waithood, and the burdens that then it I suppose imposes on those families that were expecting, you know, for this young person to be educated and then to move on and sometimes maybe to come back and assist the home.
Yeah, and that burden is both on young people and on elderly people.
Yes.
You know, in most of our cultural context, they say that young people are the walking sticks for elderly people. Mm-hmm. So when you an elderly person doesn't have a walking stick, which is a young person who has been able to actually establish themselves with resources so they can support both families and elderly, it also means that they aren't able to walk even with support. So we are facing this challenge both among young people, but also amongst elderly people. But it just means that in this context, both are trying to support each other. They're both trying to leave. You have lots of extended youths or adolescents, their parents are saying that young people are staying longer at home. You can be at the university, you can have a job, you can even, you have people also who've gone on to get married and others, but as you're staying at home, you know, with parents, and parents are still sponsoring, you know, for long periods. So it's a really difficult challenge, but it is both in the urban and as well as the rural area. So society is having so much of this, but it means that parents, at the time they are retiring, they are still continuing to take care of kids, isn't it? Even after retirement, kids who have fallen out of job or still seeking to find jobs. So even in their retirement, they are still continuing with the little resources that they're receiving, you know, to care for kids who are either in adolescence or at the university or have gone through university without jobs but still need support after. So the burden is really heavy, but it doesn't mean that society is also not investing to find its own alternatives out of it. Yeah.
And what kind of investments are you seeing that are not just, you know, I suppose I see a lot in government where they speak a lot about supports and all kinds of little projects that are happening, but I'm not sure if they are effective and I'm not sure if they are sustainable. What are you seeing that is for you something that we can say and point to as being progressive, sustainable and effective?
I would say that across the world and the continent, and particularly in this country, in South Africa, I think all governments are trying their best. So that's important to raise, because also the challenge is as much with government and also bigger than government. When you have corporate sectors that are becoming more and more richer, you have one person being paid billions, you know, of dollars. It also means the government itself is deprived of some of the resources despite these challenges. But you're having lots of youth programs. You're having lots of entrepreneurship programs that are being established also by government. Lots of startup initiatives and funds that are being established. You know, you have communities that are starting up even small initiatives for training, small entrepreneurships. You're having small corporate sectors, you know, across the country. So there is a lot of effort that people are making, communities are making, families trying to train their children or young people in different kinds of trades, providing them with resources to start up, doing the little that they can do. But in the ocean of so many different challenges where so much more can be done.
Well, when you look at, as you just said, you know, how families and young people themselves are trying to, I suppose, do with what government is trying to achieve, what does then that future look like? If you look at where we are right now and these challenges and maybe forecast to maybe 10 years from now, what do you think is likely to happen and how will all of this impact the future?
You're asking me to be a sangoma.
No, I'm asking you to be the incredible academic that you are, and you have some of the answers already. Yes.
Yes. I mean, the first thing is that I think that there are many possibilities that the future is going to offer us a space in which young people through the different entrepreneurships, startups or different trainings are actually transforming the economy, especially with what we are seeing in the digital economy, that many young people in the future will be in a space in which they control, manage, and are participating actively in the economy. But at the same time, when we see what is happening globally in terms of where resources are being invested, particularly in the wars that we are seeing, and that so much resources are being placed in those spaces, many of us are beginning to despair. You know, we see in many places educational institutions being disinvested, some disciplines being also disinvested in. It worries us that in 10 years' time, if we are not very careful, we are going to be deepening this crisis that we currently have with more unemployment. So we have to be thinking now creatively, seizing the moment, the gap that is provided to us by global processes, for us to recenter, to begin to exchange with each other, to take production more seriously, circulation in the country, on the continent, increase consumption on the continent, on the country, circulation of goods across borders, the Africa Free Trade Agreement. There's a lot that we can take advantage of in the moment of this crisis to ensure that in 10, 20, 30 years' time, actually, we have resolved this issue.
When I look at the world right now, yes, there are some wonderful, encouraging signs where there are peaceful transitions of power in the world right now because we've had many elections and it's very encouraging. We saw in Botswana closer to home and so on. But equally, I'm quite concerned about the state of the world in other parts of the world. And in some parts, you know, less reported than others. Yes, we are seeing what's happening in the Middle East and we are seeing the lens of the world focusing a lot there. But there are other parts of the world, you know, your Ethiopias, your Congo, parts of Ethiopia, your Congo, and places where conflict has been so systemic that we report less and less of it. What do you think then needs to happen with regards to young people who are in these parts of the world, the Western Sahara, where not really much has been committed to assisting these young people at a global scale?
Yeah, we are living in a context with a very painful history. And painful history that continues to reproduce itself because of global processes and also because of local action. So I think we need to acknowledge that. But also, on the other side, I think we have no choice but to hope. Mm. It's very important. So the production of hope in the context of this despair is critical. So we can continue to coalesce, we can continue to convince, we can continue to engage with different countries that we think are actually continuing in the wrong path to try to emulate examples, of some of those who are showing us good practices, but also acknowledging that not every context is the same.
Mm-hmm.
And that one solution for one might not be that different. But this continent has so much. It is a pity that we are in a place that supplies and exports so much to the global community, but still lacks. So really thinking, reflecting amongst ourselves, sharing amongst ourselves, and it's my hope that the younger generation who are engaging and interacting with each other will begin to understand that by collaborating, by cooperating, by exchanging between among themselves, you know, why do we have rice in one part of this country and another part hungry? Why do we have yams in another part and another part hungry? You know, there's so much that we can do by looking at each other. How do we balance? How do we support? How do we exchange? How do we make sure that on this continent we take seriously the idea that we are human? We take seriously the concept that we have here as Ubuntu, which others have as Teranga in Senegal, you know, Ujamaa in other spaces. How do we take that seriously and build each other, exchange with each other, and open up to each other?
As you take up this role as heading up the anthropology department at UCT, I mean, what are your plans for this department? And of course, everybody brings in a piece of themselves to the role. So what do you want to do with this particular role?
That's a big question. But let me just start by saying that, again, as I've indicated, I really take anthropology seriously. I think it's a really important discipline. And I think that in the ecosystem of disciplines and also academic knowledge production, anthropology makes a particular contribution. We have also seen anthropology in the history of the making of the world, in the history of the making of the colonies, and in the history of the making of the post-colonies. And we have seen the ways in which, on the one side, in its history, it's seen as handmaiden, but on the other side, it's been very active in progressive projects and progressive movements. It's just like the church, you know. You see on one side how we say it is really facilitating and partnering with the colonial project, but on the other side, how what would liberation and freedom be without organizing spaces as the church, you know, and others. So in going forward, you know, the anthropology department at UCT is one of the oldest anthropology departments in the world. And it's important to take that history seriously and to begin to redefine, because it means when one builds on that history and on that space, that department has been responsible in contributing to writing many of the customary laws in Southern Africa. So it's really offered us a lot. And Archima Feji came from that department. So the critique that Afima Mukherjee has given us in terms of what anthropology is, the production of knowledge, and how we take it forward with thinking South African society, thinking African society, thinking the global community, is really what I would like to center. So what would the world look like if we took those critiques really seriously? And how do we build society? How do we build community? How do we begin to introduce new modes of inquiry? Science for a long time has been the main mode of inquiry, and which is important. I take the scientific project very important, but I think the decolonial project is pushing us to also open up to other modes of inquiry, you know? But we cannot do that if we don't invest in a discipline whose job is really to understand relationships, to understand the everyday experiences and the processes by which ideas are produced, you know. We need to introduce new concepts, and an ethnography or a study of ideas, so that our African context can make contributions to understanding us, but to also understanding the global community. And I think that through that, we can even grow better as a people and also resolve a lot of the challenges that we are facing.
So let's talk about your own personal journey to get into this point, you know. And I know that you've studied other things, not just anthropology. So when did the idea of perhaps this is the direction I should be taking surface for you?
No, when I left high school, I was interested in English literature. applied, got admission into journalism, mass communication, and then political science and drama theater arts. And then I did a lot of research. I used to be a quantitative researcher before, and doing lots of survey research about development projects and many others, working environments and many communities, and did long-term ethnography, which pushed me to study development studies and also sociology. And someday, you know, if you come from particular backgrounds or places, you wait for an opportunity comes and you take it, isn't it? So I was offered an opportunity to study anthropology, which I invested in. And it really gave me the opportunity to understand another mode of inquiry and to understand another way of production and also its particular histories and the ways in which one can understand society differently, not just as statistics, but also in a really deeply qualitative manner. And I think then I was able, I studied sexuality first. I used to do work on sexual expression within the context of HIV. I was in Botswana at that time, at the height of HIV. And there was a strong push about condoms, if you remember. Mm-hmm. I think it was ADC, abstain, be careful, and then condomize, you know. And I used to walk through a street, and I saw lots of condoms that used to be on the street, lie down, and I used to ask lots of questions. How did these condoms get here, and why was it that there was lots of condoms also sometimes that seemed to not have been used? And I started asking questions, and I understood from many people then that a condom was a kind of a technology that was being inserted in an activity that was considered spontaneous and risky, you know? So if I just focused on asking questions on survey, I was going to get statistical responses. But when I really spent time trying to understand what the sociology, the social life of a condom, it allowed me to ask even more critical questions and to help those who were promoting to not just use, you know what they used to do, just bring a stick and show you how to wear it, you know? How do you just wear something, you know, without thinking about the context? The whole point of this activity is to open up yourself and be vulnerable, you know? So at the time when you're trying to be vulnerable, how do you think about risk and how do you think about protection? So really thinking that and inserting that in this a promotion of being safe, I think was very important. And I couldn't have done that without really deploying an ethnographic and a critical approach that allowed me to see people. So that's really why I'm sitting. I mean, I'm sitting on this discipline. And I think that if we are going to challenge the decolonial, really going to challenge the colonial project, if we are going to move to a space where we take ourselves as Africans and take African epistemologies, African ideas seriously, we as Africans have to invest in understanding ourselves and writing about ourselves so we can explain and make the world intelligible to us, but also through us. And that's why I've landed here.
You spoke a little bit about childhood. What was Divine's childhood like?
I grew up in the village. In a rural area, and I grew up farming very early, grew up without electricity. I first saw electricity in 1990. I first saw TV in 1988. And it was very playful, very happy. Grew up with lots of elders, and also in a place with values. That's also why I think I take African context very seriously. I take my own origin seriously. And I also take the respect for elders also very seriously, because it's the only way that I think we are able to become.
Well, congratulations to you, and the people and the community of where you grew up, I'm sure, are very proud. Whether they know this or not about your new achievement is another story. But really, really thank you for making time for us. And we look forward to the work that will be produced by the anthropology department at UCT. So thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you very much, Fernando. And have a lovely day. And thank you again for the invitation.
I appreciate it very, very much. And now the incoming head of anthropology at UCT, Professor Divine Fu.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.